Last time, in our first look at living as Christians in the 20s, we looked at maturity in a childish age. And we saw that Christians should command respect, not least in the use of their tongues, in their approach to alcohol, and in their attitude to money. This time, we're not looking at maturity in a childish age, but we're looking at stewardship in a selfish age. Now, what is stewardship? Stewardship is simply this, that our time, talents, and treasure are from God and to be used for God. Our time, talents, and treasure are from God and to be used for God. So, how can we practice stewardship in this selfish age? Well, firstly, we've got to understand the pressures that are coming on us. Romans 12 tells us not to allow the world to squeeze us into its mold, not to be conformed to the thinking of this age. Well, what is that thinking? The first thing we'll consider this evening is, what is our selfish age wanting us to think? Well, in this age, our dominant religion can be described as me-ism. Me, me, followed by me. And we don't see that anywhere more clearly than in attitudes to money. So money gives me pleasure and status. And someone described it as this attitude of, be everything you can be and enjoy the rewards. That was supposed to be one word. So be everything you can be and enjoy the rewards. Now, imagine today I could give you an exclusive £1.15 million in inheritance. You have to imagine that, because it's not accurate. But imagine I could. Would you take financial advice? I'm guessing you would. 1.15 million sounds quite a sum to handle. Now, where did I get that sum from? Well, I said if someone today worked on average earnings for 45 years, that would be their take-home pay. 45 years of average earnings. So, and if you're approaching the age of working today, wherever you start at 21, 22, if you start at that age after university, you'd have at least 45 years before the government was pleased to allow you to retire. So where are we getting our advice from in managing the sums of money that pass through our hands? Well, we could go to the BBC. BBC has got an article. I don't encourage you to read it. It's entitled, How to Spend Your Money to Make You Happier. Can you see me-ism in there? How can you spend your money to make you happier? So, number one, buy experiences for yourself. Does that not drive a lot of our age? What experience can I get each weekend? And then holidays and so on, people working for the weekend and the holidays. Number three sounds quite good. Spend money on others because it makes you happier, because you kind of feel good about yourself. So this is the kind of way our world is thinking. Think about charitable giving. What do you have? You have firms sponsoring events. Well, why are they sponsoring events? Well, that's just a form of advertising. They don't sponsor anonymously, do they? You don't see kind of anonymous, it doesn't say our local football team and it just says anonymous company on their shirts. No, they want their name on there. This is a form of advertising. Think about sponsored events. Why have we got sponsored events? Well, it's because people can feel good about giving because their name's down. They can be seen to be good by participating. It's not the biblical method of giving. I'm not saying that anyone who's ever done a sponsored event has got poor motives. I'm just saying that the general approach is all about public giving, which is the opposite of scriptural principles. Think about what we hear today about attitudes towards tax. And I think I'm probably fair in summing up this is the general attitude to tax. Number one, tax the rich. Who are the rich? Anyone richer than me? Certainly not me. I'm not rich. And second, take the money and pass it to me either in benefits or public services. I think most people would be happy with that tax policy. That's the general attitude, which again is this me-ism. And so in the age of me-ism, the whole use of money is about me. Why? Because the world says, I want experiences now. Why? well, you only live once, and there's nothing to come. So it's all about now. And I need to use money to get my reputation and status up. Why? Because there's no God to please. So it's what people think about me horizontally rather than vertically. This is all about me. So, if you want to shine like a star in the 20s, live as a steward in this selfish age. So we're not saying you only live once, but we're saying only one life will soon be passed. Only what's done for Jesus will last. And what are we saying about stewardship? The opposite of meism, it's that our time, talents, and treasure are from God and to be used for God. It's to see ourselves as God's servants and ask at the last day, will he call me good and faithful? When I have the resources that he gives me in this life, my time, my talents, and my treasure, am I using them for his glory, acknowledging him to be the provider? Now, the devil can sneak in here, as he often does. Because it's all very well saying, I'm going to use my time, talents, and treasures for his glory. And when we can put in there a very common form of modern ethics, which is antithetical, meaning it's the opposite of the way the Bible would describe it, which just says this, it's just the motive that counts. As long as we're trying to glorify God, it's okay. What's wrong with that? Who decides how we glorify God? God. How does God tell us how we glorify God? Through his word. So we need to go deep into his word to say, obviously we want to have pure motives, but motives are not enough. And in fact, we can sin with good motives. So stewardship means using my God-given time, talents, and treasure for his glory, but according to his word. Now, if we looked at time, talents, and treasure tonight, it would take a very long time. So I'm going to focus mainly on treasure, on money, partly because there's a number of scripture texts that speak to it, but also because it draws in the other things and is so particularly relevant in our age. So with that backdrop of thinking of the meism against the stewardship, let's see if we can develop five scriptural stewardship principles. Okay, so we've got our £1.15 million and we're going to God for financial advice. So our first text is 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 10. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 10. All of these are written by Paul, these five texts, and Paul tries to apply them to people saved out of the world in the early churches. So 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 10. For even when we were with you, we would give you this command. If anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. So what's the principle here? God expects us to earn enough to feed ourselves. God expects us to earn enough to feed ourselves. Now we've got to think, who is the person who's writing those words? Because you might say, well, this sounds very nasty. And if you stood up and said that today, I think, again, the BBC wouldn't be very happy with you. There would be lots of experts saying how cruel you are. Well, who's saying this? Let's think about the Apostle Paul. Why did Paul end up in a Roman jail? Because he went to Jerusalem. Why did Paul go to Jerusalem? Because he was delivering in person a large famine relief gift to try and look after people who were starving and poor. That's why Paul went to prison. And in Galatians 2 verse 10, when he's encouraged to remember the poor, he said, that's the very thing that I wanted to do. So massively high on Paul's agenda was this idea of helping the poor. But Paul made a clear distinction between the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. He wanted to help the deserving poor, and for the undeserving poor, he said, if anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. Let's think about work. When did work begin? Before the fall. Is it a good thing? Yes, it's a good thing. So in one sense, you could say that Adam and Eve were in the garden to tend and keep it. So they weren't just to kind of sit down in the garden, were they, and have some servants trot up with some food for them. That even Adam and Eve in the garden were to tend and keep the garden. And so Paul, first principle, very simply, God expects us to earn enough to feed ourselves. Remember, the backdrop of that is Paul says, if you particularly, some of the verses we're reading from 1 Timothy, if you're a widow over 60, that's very old in those days, very, very old, with low life expectancy. You can't feed yourself, you can't work, Paul says, provide for them. He commands it. Enroll them. Feed them. But if we can earn enough to feed ourselves, we should. Second principle coming up. So that's the first principle from 2 Thessalonians 3:10. Ephesians 4, verse 28. Ephesians 4 and verse 28. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. So I'm adding a second principle here from that verse. We already said that God expects us to earn enough to feed ourselves and have something left for sharing. So put it another way, if you're working hard and you're choosing how many hours to work and you've worked your hours and you've got enough to feed yourself, Paul's saying, you do an hour overtime to have something ready for sharing. That's what he's saying, isn't he? So this thief, he says, don't steal, but you'd expect him to say, don't steal, but let him do honest work. But Paul raises the bar so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. The Christian has got this outward focus. This is the opposite of meism. This is the opposite of the selfish attitude. And a very practical example of this would be hospitality. So if he's earning enough to feed himself and someone shows up, he can't offer him a meal because he's literally just got enough food to put on the table for himself. But he's saying, no, have something extra. So if there's someone in need, hospitality very big in the ancient world, you can say, come on to dinner. And there's a second jar of baked beans in the cupboard, or whatever they ate at the time. So, God expects us to earn enough to feed ourselves, principle one, and have something left for sharing. Third principle, 1 Timothy 5:8. But if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So the first two principles would apply for everyone, wouldn't they? Anyone this would apply to. And this third one's added for anyone who has a household. So God expects us to have enough to feed ourselves, number one, and have something left for sharing, number three, and provide for our household. And if you look here, you think, well, this looks a bit more serious than it does today, because it talks about his relatives and especially for members of his household. And you're thinking, wow, well, household, that's more potentially more than nuclear family if they've got servants. And relatives, well, that could get big. So this is the own household is the especially. So what's going on here? You might say, Paul, are you being a bit extreme here? He has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Why would you be worse than an unbeliever for not providing for your household? Well, think about what unbelievers don't have. Unbelievers don't have a command to love one another. Christians do. Unbelievers don't have Jesus' example. Christians do. Unbelievers don't have the Spirit's power. Christians do. And yet even unbelievers invariably or generally would seek to provide for their families, because it's natural, isn't it? Human instinct to provide. So you can see why Paul's saying it's worse than an unbeliever. If unbelievers, without the privileges we have, provide, then Christians should provide. So if you thought about a young man plucks up courage and goes to speak to a father and says, please, can I begin to meet up with your daughter because I want to start courting her to marry. And the father says to the young man, can you provide for my daughter and any future children that you might have? Well, the young man better have an answer ready. Because if he hasn't got an answer that says, yes, I'm able to provide for your daughter, or I can't provide right now, but in a year's time, I've got this job lined up, so in a very short time, I'll be able to provide, then the father is likely to say to him, well, I don't want to give my daughter in its hand in marriage to someone who's worse than an unbeliever, so come back when you can answer that question positively. This is the level that this is placed at, and we need to be thinking on these lines. So that's our principles. Number one, God expects us to earn enough to feed ourselves and have something left for sharing and provide for our household. Could it get worse? Yes. Okay. 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 2. When I say worse, that's probably the wrong thing to say. I should say, could it get more challenging? 1 Corinthians 16, verse 2. Paul says, on the first day of every week, each of you is to put something aside and store it up as he may prosper, so that there may be no collecting when I come. Paul's talking about a collection for the saints. So all we're trying to establish here is a further principle, and it would simply be this, and to give systematically as we prosper. Does Paul state an amount? He just says, this has got to be systematic. How do I say systematic? It's each week something's being put aside. So it's not just like, oh, well, you kind of, Paul turns up and people are kind of reaching their pockets and any change? He's saying, no. Each week, first day of the week, Lord's Day on the Sunday, you put something aside. You do it systematically. And it's kind of in proportion. This is stewardship, isn't it? Because you're saying, what's God given me? As you prosper, so the more money God gives you, the more money you put aside. That's the principle. To give systematically as we prosper. So that's the fourth principle. So let's go through those again. God expects us to earn enough to feed ourselves, have something left for sharing, and provide for our household, and to give systematically as we prosper. That's systematically to the church as we prosper. So those four things. There's a fifth thing that we need to have because of imbalanced views in this area. And this is the fifth principle. It's found in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 17. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 17. Paul addresses those who are rich. As for the rich in this present age, that's a slightly sneaky comment, isn't it? It's basically saying, by the way, there's going to be a big leveller when they die. But as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides with us everything to enjoy. Now, here's the fifth principle, that the things we have, we are to enjoy. Now, why is it important to underline this? Because some people in the past have gone so big on sacrifice that they've, which is an important principle of doing things for others, that you almost see any kind of enjoyment of anything as sinful. Now, Calvin pointed out that God's made food to taste nice. Anyone like that? Food tastes nice? Calvin also pointed out that clothes, as well as covering us, can also look nice. And that flowers smell nice. So Calvin's basically saying, in the goodness of God, God's made things that are not just practical, but nice. And I remember being on a beach fishing team when I was about 15 at the time, and someone gave me a lift, and I got in this car. And then they started kind of apologising for the car that they had. I said, well, I didn't really buy it myself, but it was a gift for my parents. I was like, what? you've got a car, because at age 15, I wasn't too up on what cars would cost or anything like this. But obviously, this person was kind of slightly embarrassed. Obviously, this car was probably more expensive than they'd have bought themselves and was trying to justify that they hadn't bought it. We don't want to have a Christian culture when we're judgmentally looking down on other people. Like, car pulls into the car park. No. No, Rolls Royce, not that. I can safely say Rolls Royce. Haven't seen one of those outside. But you just imagine, on a practical level, we could all, say, have been given £50 to go shopping. And some of us would, and we could then look at what each other have bought for the shopping for a certain time. And someone's like, oh, I wouldn't have wasted money on that brand. You could have got own brands. But then you've got branded something else, and they'll say, I wouldn't have got branded for that. We make decisions, don't we? And we've got to have the Christian love and respect for one another, that we're stewards before God. And that's why this principle is really important. God says he gives us all things richly to enjoy. So that means we receive them as presents. If God makes us prosper, we think, wow, God's being kind to us. We receive it with thanks. It's not an entitlement to us. We don't have that entitlement. Well, they've got it, I should have it. No. We receive it with thanks, not entitlement. And we don't look at other people and start making value judgments based on, well, they shouldn't be enjoying that. Well, they shouldn't spend it. No. What is stewardship? Stewardship is me before God. It's not wrong to enjoy things. There will be people who are richer in the present age. They just will. That's just the way it works. So, what are we saying? God gives us time, talents, and treasure to feed ourselves and have something left for sharing and to provide for our household and to provide systematic giving and to enjoy. So, stewardship sometimes, and I think this is the tendency in recent years, has been downplayed. At one stage, this was really big. Some of you who are older than I am may remember when stewardship and sacrifice were really big. Since then, there's been a reaction against it. Stewardship's been downplayed because of perceived extreme and judgmentalism. But even if we're not saying we live to give every last penny for evangelism, we must live to steward every penny for God's purposes. Is that not right? We steward every penny for God's purposes, according to Scripture, which are the principles that we've been looking at. Well, let's now really concretize this and look at three examples of stewardship in practice. So, let's start. We'll work our way up in ages. So if you think you're going to, I'm just targeting young men. I'm going to start with the young men, but we're going to get older. Okay, so we'll start with the young men and we'll go up in stages, young men. So we've already thought a little bit about young men needing to, if you're interested in marriage, of needing to put 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8 into practice. And let's just think a bit more about that, the need to provide. Because what's the world's backdrop? The world's backdrop basically says, well, you can work, the woman can work, you can both put money in there, and you both work full time, and that's all you need to do. Well, aside from the fact that a godly girl may be looking at a godly man, and he might think, well, she's just checking out if I'm kind, nice, and I've washed my hair today. She might be asking the question, well, she's her main role is going to be a homemaker. And so she's thinking, well, can I imagine a situation when he's coming home from work and I've got the family around me? So if you go into marriage thinking, well, we're both going to work. Now, what will that mean if the schooling system gets worse and worse and worse and you're thinking, I need to withdraw my children from school? Well, if your economic model says you both must work, you have no chance. Now, hear me carefully. I'm not saying all Christians must homeschool. I am saying that if you set yourself up economically that homeschooling is never an option, then you're basically saying to the state, whatever you want to tell them, tell them. You've made the decision before you have started. And so stewardship, again, if you're thinking, are you stewarding, those of you younger, what you already have? So let's think in terms of talents. So there's confusion today between what people like to do and what they need to do to earn. So on a simple level, because I've seen this in schools before, you get someone and say, what do you like to do? And the person says, oh, well, I'd like to be a professional footballer. And I've had someone sitting in front of me before, and I've said to him, you're not going to be a professional footballer. And he got very angry with me. How dare you say I'm not going to be a professional footballer? I basically said, whose books are you on? You're not. Okay. You're not a professional footballer. Let's just be realistic. So there's this kind of dreaming world that is being encouraged. You get someone who likes the guitar. You say, I like the guitar. I say, that's great. I'm glad you like the guitar. I enjoy playing the guitar. But you need to earn some money. So I'd looked up a few figures. How about this? If you leave school at 16 on the minimum wage, by 21, after taxes, you'd have earned £60,000, and by 25, you'd have earned £130,000. If you went from university onto a minimum wage job by the age of 28, you'd have earned £120,000. These are significant sums. So you're just thinking, how am I going to steward the money that I might have? And so if we're thinking biblically about stewardship, we're thinking the sums that I get, what am I going to do with them? And what will that mean later on? What will that mean later on in terms of housing? So if you're a young man or young lady, what money are you putting aside to go into housing to allow you later on in this age to get into home ownership and give money, not just pay someone else's mortgage? So that's thinking a little bit about young people. We might think about discussing some of those later on. But let's go up one age bracket and think about those of us who are parents. So we've got to ask the question, are we teaching our children the principles of stewardship? So our children are growing up in a culture of me-ism. Do you know when the term teenager was coined? Where does the term teenager come from? It wasn't there in the 19th century. When did it take off? It took off, most people think, in the 1950s as a marketing term. The marketers worked out there was a market they could tap which had people with disposable income and a lack of discernment. That's great for a marketer, isn't it? Disposable income, lack of discernment. Let's market them as teenagers and have a whole load of products that we can sell to them. Great. And so from then, you've got this idea of people being consumers rather than stewards. So as parents, are we in the way that we handle money and in the practical ways we teach our children and saying, look, you're surrounded by people who just get money to spend it. Consumerism. But actually, everyone is a steward, Christian or non-Christian. Because the money's from God. That's the biblical principle. So we've thought about those who are younger. We've thought about those who are parents. What about those who are maturer saints? So let's think about this. Are we maintaining stewardship principles in our later years? What is our attitude to later years? Now, Joel Beakey tells this story of someone coming into his office one day. And they came to him and said, I've been saving up for my retirement. Now, the context is you're in Michigan and there's a big lake there, but we can identify with this. We're on the coast. I've been saving up for retirement and I've saved up and I've got the money finally to buy myself a boat. This must be some significant sum to buy a boat to go on Lake Michigan. But I've been convicted that this is all about me and I think it should go to the Lord's work. Here's the money. Can you do something with it? thinking, wow, that's like, that's kind of like an all or nothing thing, isn't it? It's just like the whole sum of the money. But that principle is from that. Let's think of a principle and say, in your use of money, is it a me and my pleasures, or is it a God's and his uses? Now, again, we've got to get this balance, because God does give these things richly to enjoy. So by that example, I'm not saying that we don't have things to enjoy. What I am saying is, let's think about principles. What would you say stewardship is? Using our God-given time, talents, and treasures to his glory. Now, you might say, well, I'm in retirement. I've got a very limited income. In your retirement, what do you have more of? Not necessarily treasures. Your talents may be, depending on your strength, you may struggle to use some of them. But time is probably quite a high commodity that you've got. You may have loads more hours than before. How might you invest those hours in encouraging other believers, in getting involved in things with the church and so on? So that there may be, and getting involved in prayer. So your stewardship may have a different shape to it, but it's not that it's not there. Again, that's something we could consider. Now, one thing I found interesting in my time in the States is that people's houses are different. So they have two-level houses rather than two-story houses. So the standard house, and I was talking to someone about this recently, is like a bungalow. But they don't call them bungalows. You go in, you've got this kind of long bungalow. And then you think, well, this is not very big. And then they say, well, let's just go down the basement. Like, the basement? Everyone's got a basement, seemingly. You go down the basement, you've basically got the same footprint again. And it can be like with full kitchen, toilet. It's like a second house. You've kind of got like a bungalow above the ground where people live. And then the bungalow below the ground in the basement. And one thing they often do, you find like a young married couple living in the basement of someone, basically saying, look, you stay there, you won't charge much rent, and get on with saving for the future. And this might be something not just parents, but even as they do in the States, if we want to invest in the next generation in the church, we might want to be considering. So for the vast majority of 1950 to the year 2000, the average house price was 4 to 5 times average earnings. Today, it's over 8 times. So therefore, this might mean thinking through, as a church community, how we can invest in encouraging younger people to be able to amass a substantial deposit, which they need simply because of the changed economic climate. Now, I've tried to kind of push out some thinking in those, but let's get back as we conclude to the principles. Remember, we're thinking about stewardship in a selfish age. Living with eternity in view means a life lived for his smile. Our times, talent, and treasures from God, and to be used for God. Now, think back to the time of the Reformation. It brought an end to a compartmentalized life. What was going on before the Reformation? You had the sacred, you do your ritual, then you had the secular, you get on with the rest of life. But the Reformation says everything is sacred. There's not God's part and my part. Even as believers, are we not tempted to think about that? There's God's part with his part of my time, talents, and treasures, and then there's the me part. Instead, we're called to have that holistic, positive vision. And we can think about this as we conclude. God, positively, is always at work, isn't he? And we image him as we work. God loves us enough to give us time, talents, and treasures. And God even gives us unmerited rewards if we're good and faithful with what he's given us. We have the greatest master. Should we not be the greatest stewards? Not with someone else's time, treasure, time and talent and treasures, but with my time, talent and treasures. Amen.